And welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. Josh Parcell here with you, the founder of College Football Country. Rossi Three Stacks going to stop by in just a minute. We'll recap the best weekend of the year so far in college football. Wild weekend, Clemson, Notre Dame, Florida, Georgia. Of course, we'll talk about our alma mater's embarrassing loss to Liberty. We've got a lot to talk about in today's pod. But first, just a reminder, guys, please download and subscribe to the podcast. If this is your first time checking it out, we appreciate it. Welcome. Hello. Greetings. Hope you guys enjoy it. And subscribe, rate, review, do all the things that help us out. We appreciate you guys listening. And if you would just do us that favor, we'd appreciate you even more. We're back to doing two podcasts a week. We've got a very special announcement coming up, hopefully later this week, definitely soon. So you're going to want to subscribe so you can hear what we have planned for you guys coming up in the very near future. Can't wait to announce it. Should be soon. In the meantime, let's get to a crazy weekend in college football with my good buddy, Rossi Three Stacks.
You are looking live at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta.
No, they didn't. Oh, my gracious. Yep. How about that?
Lawrence took a peek downfield, had a lot of room, and breaks the tackle, and is still running. Lawrence in a foot race. Will they catch him? Touchdown, Tigers! Wow!
Well, he has trouble with the snap, and the ball is free! It's picked up by Michigan State's Jalen Watts-Jackson, and he scores on the last play of the game! Unbelievable!
All right, so why do you continually try to get me to say something I'm not going to? So quit asking.
Will Ross, week one has come and gone again. The Pac-12 back, the MAC back, the SEC here for now, but we may have another week one in the SEC in like 2 weeks because it feels like the season's about to be shut down, but what a weekend.
What a weekend indeed, man. Fun slate of games for sure. Some dramatic finishes, some convincing wins from some top five teams. Lot to like this weekend.
Yeah, they call it Shake Up Saturday. That's what I've always heard.
That's what I've been calling it for weeks. You hear it more and more every day.
So we got a lot to talk about in today's show. We're going to switch up the format here today. We're trying to go back to two podcasts a week. So we're going to look back at what happened on Saturday. Wild day. We'll start with studs. We're going to do studs and duds today. So let's get right to it, man. Let's get to the studs of the weekend. I feel like we have to start with the Fighting Irish. I mean, wake up the echoes. The ACC leading Notre Dame Fighting Irish, getting the win in double overtime against Clemson. Can I just say right off the bat, here's my first takeaway. Obviously, there's a lot of playoff implications, and we'll talk about what this means for Clemson and all that. The fact that this game snapped Clemson's ACC winning streak a week before they would have broken the record is asinine. I don't mind Notre Dame being in the ACC. I'm fine with that. I don't mind the logo being painted on the field. I don't mind them playing for the conference championship. But the fact that Clemson was a game away from setting the record for most wins in a row in the conference, and now that streak is over because of a random year where Notre Dame's in the ACC, yeah. I hate that so much.
Look, if Notre Dame was in the ACC – like starting now and moving forward, like they were in again next year, for instance, and beyond, then it's no big deal. But if we look back and Notre Dame never joins the ACC as a football member, and this was just the only year, then that is going to be just a giant asterisk on Clemson's streak there. And such a bad look for the ACC. I'm with you.
Yeah. I don't mind everything else about Notre Dame being in the league. It's totally fine. But I hate it because not only would have Clemson broken the record next week, but it would have been Florida State's record, and they would have broken it in Tallahassee. It would have been really cool. And maybe I sound like I'm standing up for Clemson right now, but I don't care. I thought that would have been awesome, and it's just ridiculous that of all the things for, of all the games for them to lose, I guess, it's against the team that's here for, you know, on rental for a year. So that's really dumb.
They're not here for a long time. They're here for a good time. But well, they had a good time on Saturday.
Hell yeah, man. What were your initial thoughts? What were your biggest takeaways from that game? Because that was a marathon of a game. The last quarter and a half, well, overtime. The last quarter and overtime, I felt like took 3 hours.
Big time. I was like getting ready to go to bed Saturday night, not to brag, sick life that I live, and just kept being like, you know what, I'm gonna wait till the end of this game. And then I felt like I was up for another hour and a half after that. But no, that actual takeaways of the game was, it was funny that we made such a big deal about Trevor Lawrence being out, we being fans in general.
Now say we didn't.
We actually did not. You're right. Some people were making a big deal about Trevor Lawrence being out.
The elite media.
Actually, the big media. The fake news media was all over Trevor Lawrence, giving no credit to DJU. But in actuality, it was all the guys on defense that were out that was the biggest issue. Kyren Williams, huge game for Notre Dame. He was very impressive. ACC running back of the week. But man, they look good. I think I've been kind of fading Notre Dame for a couple weeks gambling wise, and they came out and they rose to the occasion. And I mean, they stood toe to toe with Clemson, but this, I think, so two things. One, Notre Dame looked good. They were legit. They rose to the occasion. Number two, this was clearly not the Clemson team that we are going to see by the end of the year, but not just because of Trevor Lawrence.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, we'll get to the Trevor part of this in a minute, but just to focus on Notre Dame. So I'll say one thing in defense of Clemson here for a minute. You talk about Kyren Williams having a huge game. The first play of the game goes 65 yards for a touchdown, right? Right, yep. Out of the gate. Boom. Notre Dame takes a 7-0 lead. All of a sudden, it completely changes the tone of that football game. Notre Dame has some confidence there. But the rest of the game, Ross, Kyren Williams, 75 yards on 22 carries. It's not like they really dominated Clemson on the ground in this game. The star to me was Ian Book. And that was a guy we talked about going into the game too, that, you know, Book has, you know, the narrative on him is that he really hasn't improved. He hasn't had those big moments. You know, since 3 years ago, it's just kind of been the same guy. And then
poor man's Phil Dracovic. That's what I've been saying for weeks.
We were ready. I'll tell you what, we were ready to crown Dracovic the king of, what did we call him last week? I don't remember. Ian Encyclopedia.
Ian Novella. Ian Pulitzer, I think. Is what we
saw Pulitzer. Well, you know what? Maybe Ian Book was listening, because all he did was respond with the best game of his career. He was outstanding in this game, extending plays, picking up first downs with his legs, 68 yards, 310 yards passing. If that's the Ian Book that you're getting, I understand that Clemson had some injuries on the other side, but if that's the Ian Book you're getting, Notre Dame is legit. And I don't think Notre Dame will beat Clemson in a rematch. I don't. I think and really has nothing to do with Lawrence. It's mostly getting the defense healthier. I think that will make a big difference. But nevertheless, it's not like Clemson was trotting out some walk-ons from, you know, down the road.
No, not at all.
Brian Brise, Miles Murphy, like, they had a lot of young kids making big-time plays. They've still got, you know, 4- and 5-star kids littered across the defense. I think you have to tip your hat to Notre Dame. The loss doesn't really matter for Clemson too much, but for Notre Dame, I think it's fair to say that this team is, if they lose, here's my question to you. If they lose to Clemson tight in the ACC championship, let's just say they win out, which isn't a given, but if they win out, if they lose a close one to Clemson in the ACC championship game, I know a lot has to, you know, shake itself out around the rest of the country, but feels to me like Notre Dame would have a very good case to make the playoff.
It's going to be super interesting between them, potentially a Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of teams out there that will make for a really interesting discussion. I mean, we'll, you know, potentially an undefeated Oregon. I mean, what do you do with them? BYU, potentially, like, it's going to be a super interesting discussion. We said it earlier this year, man, more than ever this season, we needed an 8+ team playoff, because it's just so hard to compare some of these resumes when you're only looking at these like uneven conference schedules and different amounts of games. And so, yeah, they would be right there though, to answer your question. Now, what I think is going to happen is they do get there. And Clemson will beat them by 3+ touchdowns, full strength. That is my prediction now. Clemson wins this rematch handily. In this game, on this night, Notre Dame took it to him. I was also, last thing, the actual game itself, I was really impressed with Notre Dame's receivers. We've been talking a lot about how they don't really have the skill position players to match up against Clemson. And they had some big receivers They went up and made very impressive catches.
Oh, yeah.
Ian Book did play well. I agree. He played well. The best game of the season for him. But he was not bailed out, but he was helped out by some receivers going up and making some incredible catches, which is what you have to do to pull an upset like that. Like, that's, those are guys making big-time plays. But I thought Notre Dame play, other than a fumble here or there, I thought they played close to their A game. I just don't think they could do that again. So we'll see.
And they sold out to stop ETN too. I mean, they loaded right. the box. They said, we're going to, I mean, they know DJU is tremendous, but let's sell out. Let's make the freshman beat us. He nearly did, but I mean, ETN was a non-factor in this game, but that's a credit to Notre Dame's defense. They are absolutely legit. My last point on this, this is the best thing that could have happened for college football. I know it was a weird game with no Lawrence, and it's, you know, you could put an asterisk on the game if you want, but college football needs Clemson and Alabama and Ohio State to lose, period. We're not going in a great direction when Clemson's undefeated at the end of the year. So is Bama, or, you know, LSU last year, Ohio State. When it's the same three or four teams, and I understand Notre Dame's been there. It's not like this was, you know, some colossal upset, but this was a game that was, you know, a Notre Dame team that was an underdog at home and getting to beat the number one team in America. You need more surprises like that. And now there is real intrigue. There is real intrigue in this playoff race because, as you mentioned, you know, A&M, Florida, which we'll get to in a minute, they're in the conversation as a one-loss team. You know, we'll see what happens with Alabama, Ohio State. There's the usuals, but a couple of teams now on that periphery, not to mention some of those group of five schools like Cincinnati and BYU. It's just good to have intrigue on who can get in. And sure. Clemson is more vulnerable. This is now the second or third time that Clemson has played a game where they don't quite look like they're all put together. This one you can understand because of some injuries, but I liked it. I liked it. It feels like there is no flawless team in college football this year. That's a really good thing.
And Notre Dame being one of those teams is really important. I mean, people rightfully kind of bash Notre Dame and I think they don't like their fan base, whatever. They are what they are. College football is more fun when Notre Dame's good.
Yep.
They're more fun. It's more fun when USC is good. I would even throw teams like Florida State into that mix. Like
Texas.
It's more fun when Texas for sure. Yeah, that's the obvious one. It's a lot of fun when those teams are all good. So that's a great point. This was a win for college football. I'm with you.
Meanwhile, speaking of DJU, our boy, do you think it's possible he might be better than Trevor? Like not right this second. Like let's go back 2 years.
Could he be?
There's no way you could rule that out. There's no way you could rule that out.
No, you can't rule it out. I mean, you said. You used the Jamarcus Russell comparison when we talked last week. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who you said.
It was Greg McElroy.
Greg McElroy, yeah. Yep. Jamarcus Russell was arguably the most, like, purely talented. I mean, he was number one overall pick for a reason. And if that's the kind of guy you're tossing him around, I mean, I think the ceiling is potentially the roof with DJU. So, yeah, I mean, maybe. But it's crazy to even have that discussion when Trevor Lawrence has been talked about for 3 years now as a generational quarterback prospect. So, I mean, ultimately, no, I don't think he will end up being as good. But could he be? Sure. I mean, well, this would have seemed wild a couple of years ago to talk about. But he reminds me a little bit of Josh Allen also. We see what Josh Allen is doing in the NFL right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's having an incredible year. This is a guy with that kind of physical makeup, arm talent. We're seeing it now in the NFL. Maybe Jamarcus Russell was before his time. Or I think, like you said last week, it was off-field stuff. But this is the kind of guy that could come in and pretty much immediately win games for an NFL team and, you know, be a Super Bowl caliber quarterback. And we're seeing that after a game and a half. So, yeah, the upside's there for sure, man.
I think that if he entered the draft – tomorrow he'd go in the top 20. I just think he would. And I've said for a long time that the 3-year rule in college is stupid, and I get why the NFL does it, but it's more obvious now than ever that these kids are ready earlier. Not everybody, but the elites. And this kid is as developed physically as any 18-year-old quarterback I've ever seen, including Trevor. I mean, sure. his build at 250 pounds, the way he moves, how effortless. The first touchdown pass he threw, which was to Cornell Powell, it's like a 55-yarder in the air. It was effortless. It was like he was playing soft toss in the backyard. There's not very many guys that have that kind of just effortless throwing motion. Michael Vick comes to mind. Josh Allen's a good one. I mean, a guy who just has an absolute rocket attached to his shoulder where he can throw it 60 yards like it's nothing. DJ's got that. It was special, dude. It was really, really special. I think he's going to be tremendous. And, you know, I want to dig more into this. Maybe somebody listening can tweet at me what they think is a better run than what Clemson's had. But if you look at the last, you know, 6 or 7 years and then just look at the next 2 or 3 with DJ, I don't know that any school has ever had a better 10-year run at quarterback than what Clemson's in the middle of. I mean, to go from Taj Boyd, but Deshaun Watson basically to Trevor. I know there was the year and a half of Kelly Bryant in the middle of that, but you're basically going Deshaun, Trevor Lawrence, and then DJ. That is hard to top.
It looked like USC was going to have that, but then a couple of their guys post-liner didn't pan out.
Right.
All of Clemson's guys are panning out. Yeah, I will almost certainly be looking into that after we are done here, because that's a great question.
USC, because they had Carson Palmer and then Leinart, and then,
correct.
John David Booty was in the middle of that. Sanchez was good, but I don't think Sanchez is on the level of any of these three guys that Clemson's got now. So this might be the best run at quarterback. Homegrown quarterbacks, too, because Oklahoma won a couple Heismans.
Yeah.
But those were transfers. That's great and everything, but I'm going to give Clemson credit here for recruiting these guys, keeping them, and developing them. That is an incredible run. So shout out to DJ. You 440 yards, a couple touchdowns, absolutely unreal performance from him.
He was awesome.
So let's go to another stud here, Ross. I have a full-blown man crush. It is official on Kyle Pitts. And what he does, the tight end out of Florida, he's the most unguardable guy I've seen in college since probably Calvin Johnson. I mean, he is a complete mismatch. There's nobody that can guard this guy. He absolutely torched Georgia. Unfortunately, he got hurt. He took a shot to the head on a targeting call in the second half of that game. Florida, once they started going to Kyle Pitts, they fell behind 14-0 quickly, come back to win 44-28. But Pitts was the most unstoppable player on the field. He's the reason Florida won that game, even though he went out, you know, midway through the second half.
Yeah, he's awesome, man. I think he's slowed down a little bit from our one touchdown per quarter, two touchdown per half stretch that we had him on through a couple weeks. But he's unbelievable. I'm already kind of circling him as my starting fantasy football quarter or tight end. I mean, I'll put him a quarterback too, whatever. But certainly my tight end in a couple of years. As you know, Josh, I always name my fantasy team after my tight end, or at least I usually do. So there's some pretty good stuff you can do with Kyle Pitts too. So I've got this guy circled. You're gonna be hearing a lot more of him in my life in the next few years. But no, man, he's awesome. It's very fun to watch just a freak of nature, which at the tight end position especially. I don't know. He is a joy to watch for sure.
So he's got 8 touchdowns right now. He's got over 400 yards. He only has 24 catches, which seems crazy, but the guy turns every catch into a touchdown. It's like the guy he'd have more catches if he wasn't, you know, breaking 6 tackles on his way to the end zone. He only had 2 catches in that Georgia game. It felt like he had more, but like I said, once they kind of realized they could go to him when they needed him, he was unstoppable.
Did he really only have 2 catches?
Yeah, it felt like more. I was honestly shocked when I looked at that.
That is a loud 2 catches.
I know. 59 yards and a touchdown. I don't know that he's going to have the numbers when it's all said and done. But you'd be hard-pressed for me to find a guy I'd rather vote for the Heisman than this guy. I think he is the best player that I've seen in college football this year. I mean, you think about Lawrence being out. Justin Fields, late start to the season, isn't really going to have a game. Like, nobody in the Big Ten's any good. So Fields is not going to have any moment in this season where he's going to be tested. He's going to be playing cream puffs every week. So I don't even know how good of a chance Fields has at the award. Etienne has the rough game against Notre Dame. Quietly, Ian Book should probably, I mean, after what he did on Saturday, I believe he should probably be in this conversation. But Kyle Pitts is the most dominant player all season long to me. And, yeah, it's crazy he only had 2 catches in that game. But he's going to be a top 10 pick. He's going to be an absolute freak at the next level. I, I'd be shocked if he lasted past like the top six or seven. He's just exactly what the NFL wants these days. You're Travis Kelce. You're Zach Ertz. I mean, you're George Kittle. That's what Kyle Pitts is, and every team is looking for those guys. There's not many of them around.
Yep, no doubt. Yeah, he's awesome. That's a good one. Definitely a stud this weekend and every weekend.
So who else? So we got a couple more studs this week, Ross. How about the Hoosiers? We got to give them some love, man. The Indiana Hoosiers, the Fighting Tom Allens, going up and knocking off Michigan. Somehow Michigan was favored in this game, which, I mean, we should have been on this one, honestly, last week. That is a brand name bias written all over it. Indiana stomps Michigan. This game was never close, and the Hoosiers win at 38-21. It was 24-7 at halftime. We could talk about the Michigan side of this all we want, and most people probably will, but shout out to Indiana, who is now, I believe, in the top 10. They're 10. Yeah, they moved up to 10, 10th in the AP poll. So should we officially – I feel like it's probably too late to jump on the Hoosier bandwagon, man.
I haven't been on the Hoosier bandwagon since Tevin Coleman left. But I know that was a dude. They're a lot of fun. I think it's something – there's something fun about your traditional basketball programs having these, like, flash-in-the-pan – football seasons, and who knows if this is going to last. Like, I don't know that they're going to end the season in the top 10. Probably not. They take a peek at the schedule, and there's a big one looming next weekend.
Right.
And if they make it to the Wisconsin game a couple weeks after that, like, realistically, they're going to drop a couple games. But, dude, good for them. In the meantime, enjoy this run. They don't get but so many shots to beat a Michigan. And I think the reason I stayed away from it is, one, I didn't think Indiana, well, they escape against Penn State, and then they beat Rutgers. So I was like, I don't know if I fully buy into this yet. And give Harbaugh credit, he has not won basically a single big game at Michigan, but he tends to beat everybody he is supposed to beat. That's starting to change now too, which spells big time trouble for Michigan and Harbaugh.
No, it no question does, and you have to think that they're figuring out an exit strategy there. Maybe it's not this year because of everything that's going on, but once you hit a certain point, it's hard to turn it back around. And there's a few programs that can say the same thing right now with Michigan. But Ross, here is why we are officially on the Indiana bandwagon. It's not too late. We can, as long as we get on before the Ohio State game, we can say we were there when they go in and knock off the Buckeyes. Here's why.
Okay.
Michael, here are the names on this Indiana offense. This is an all-name team, all on the same team. Michael Penix Jr., which we know, we talked about him on the podcast before, not to be confused with Michael Penix Jr., which we thought it was a few weeks ago. Nope, not the same guy. Michael Penix, their running backs are Stevie Scott III, which I like. That's okay. That's a good name. Stevie Scott III. Samson James, strong name. Then we get to the receivers. Wop Fillior. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Wop. Wop Fillior. And do you know why his name is Wop? I'm going to give you a guess. Why is his name Wop?
I have absolutely no idea.
So if I bet if you just think of like a really obvious reason. Like, what if you could think of any reason why a kid would be named WAP, and it's not Cardi B?
Would he mispronounce, like, a family member's name, and it came out as WAP?
Oh, okay. Good guess. No. So, apparently, he ate Whoppers every day growing up. So, they started calling him WAP. That's his name. And somehow, he became a wide receiver. Feels like that'd be a better name for a right tackle, like 360 pounds. But, yeah, WAP Fillior.
Amazing.
So good. And then, not to be topped, but the other wide receiver, the second leading receiver, Ty Freifogel.
Jeez.
Yeah. They got some good ones, man.
They do have some good ones. Well, go Hoosiers. Good for them. Josh, last stud of the weekend for me. We got to make our obligatory Coastal Carolina mention. The boys kept rolling. 23-6 against South Alabama. Huge matchup looming on the 21st, not this weekend, but the following weekend. If they can take care of business against Troy this weekend, huge game against App State. The scrappy Fun Belt teams from North and South Carolina, respectively, huge matchup on the 21st. They got to get through Troy this weekend, though.
So Coastal Carolina might just be really good. I mean, they're not Sun Belt good. They might be. They're probably not on Cincinnati's level. It's hard for me. I mean, just the level that Cincinnati recruits and even the level BYU recruits. But, I mean, what they did, we didn't talk about them really 2 weeks ago, but what they did to Georgia State, that was a trendy upset pick 2 weeks ago against Georgia State. And people thought, well, you know, Georgia State, they could have been undefeated, couple close games, this line might be a little bit off. Grayson McCall did play as their quarterback, but people felt like that was a chance for Coastal Carolina to get upset. They won that game 51-0. I mean, that was as emphatic of a statement as you can make. And you know, this started as a joke. You know, 2 months ago, we were joking around, oh, team of the podcast, America's team, Coastal Carolina. I mean, here they are in the top 15. I mean, it's going to be hard for them to top the other two teams that are in the group of five. So I guess they're still going to end up in, like, the New Orleans Bowl or whatever. But they deserve something more. I can't wait to see them play App State. That's going to be a hell of a game in a couple of weeks.
And super fun game.
Did you see what their coach said? I think – what was the bet? He said, I think if it was that they go undefeated, he'll cut a mullet because everybody's growing the mullets down there on the team right now.
Yeah, that's right.
That is a great bet.
They got App State, and then they got our good friends, the Liberty Flames, at the end of the year. God. So maybe we'll use that as an excuse to transition into our duds of the weekend, Josh. And there was a big dud in Blacksburg, Virginia on Saturday.
Yeah, there was. Liberty wins 38-35. I'm very conflicted on how to react after this game because I try not to be – I mean, it's no secret. We're Virginia Tech guys. I've been a Virginia Tech guy my whole life. So I'm close to the program. It's close to my heart. And I pride myself on being very objective. I try very hard. I mean, it's no secret I'm a fan, but I try to be very reasonable with, you know, after a loss or even after a big win. I try not to overreact. There's two times where I felt like I've either overreacted or just kind of lost my mind after a game. Not, and it wasn't like Old Dominion, I didn't. JMU a long time ago, I didn't. But you know, the Duke game last year, which I mean everybody agrees at Virginia Tech, that was as low of a moment as that program's had in a long time.
You called it, I think you called it, you said you felt like you were watching the funeral for the program, I think is how you phrased it last year.
It did. And then just like the Undertaker, they busted out of the casket last year. Found a way to, you know, get back to a nice bowl game, and it felt like things were headed in the right direction. But, you know, this loss on Saturday, Liberty is they're not good, all right? But they're at least they're a passable opponent. This isn't like losing to JMU or losing to Old Dominion, all right? The name Liberty doesn't match the program right now. It's a good enough program where the loss isn't some like horrific, unfathomable upset that nobody ever saw coming. People thought Liberty might win this game. I didn't, but people did. The problem is the way that they lost. And, you know, one of the most unfathomable endings to a game where Fuente ices a kicker on a 59-yarder. The kid was, I think, 2 of 6 on field goals longer than 40 yards this season. I mean, it's not Mike Vanderjag back there. And he's icing this kicker on a 60-yarder in an empty stadium, which everybody, I'm sure if you're listening, you know, they block the kick, it gets overturned. But the thing that everyone wants to point to that timeout, and that's fine, like that was a bad decision. But the worst decision was on the next play to treat it as if Liberty needed a touchdown or bust. To put 6 guys back on the goal line in a tie game on 4th and 8, and Liberty throws a wide open out route, picks up 12 yards or whatever, and then, you know, boots the 50-yarder and wins the game. That's the worst coaching decision. The icing the kicker, all right, there's a lot of coaches out there who would probably do the same thing, even if it's the wrong decision, but it's inexcusable to make the mistake that they made that set up the game-winning field goal itself.
Yes, I agree. So you mentioned the empty stadium thing. You're talking about the icing the kicker thing. That doesn't, maybe it is getting talked about enough, but that was the craziest thing to me as I was watching. The whole point of icing someone is to like let them feel the weight of the moment,
right,
and think about it too much, which gets becomes way worse when you're in this full stadium and you've got the crowd yelling and you feel the energy and all that. When it's just an empty stadium, I mean, it basically feels more like a kick in practice, especially when it was a tie game. So anyway, all of that said, I thought it was a really dumb timeout. I don't get the icing thing when it's, I mean, not a live ball, I guess I threw it out of bounds, but when you're running the kicking team onto the field, it's not like coming out of a timeout. So the kid has to quickly get out there and try to set up for the longest kick of his life. I just don't get those kind of timeouts. But yeah, the one after that, like, holy cow. That is the thing where Virginia Tech players and fans should be rightfully upset at just a very, very poorly managed situation. And that's the thing where we have been spoiled. They have been spoiled by Bud Foster making very, very good situational decisions throughout his entire career. Like, say, if you could boil Bud Foster's success down to anything, it is a sense of the moment in the game and when to call certain things, when to dial up pressure, when to sit back. Like, Bud Foster did that better than anyone probably ever as a defensive coordinator. And we're starting to see that kind of stuff bubble up in the coaching staff after decades of not having it. So it was just never, it's never been more clear than it was in that moment.
So I agree. And I think there's a couple different conversations that had to be had today. First of all, I never would have imagined we'd be here 3 years ago. That after the way that Fuente started, it felt like this guy understood how to transition from a legendary coach as well as anybody I've seen. It was
seamless. And he nailed it. He nailed it.
Completely nailed it. It was, they were off to it just at such an excellent start. We could go back in time and talk about, you know, some of the kids who went pro and some of the kids who were kicked off the team. And he dealt with a lot of roster issues that I think, frankly, he takes too much blame for. He doesn't deserve the amount of blame that he gets from people that, you know, aren't really following the program every single day for some of the attrition that they've had. Having said that, this is now the fifth time that he has lost a game as a double-digit favorite in 5 years. And that is inexcusable. I'm not overreacting when I say that can't happen. I mean, you can lose games. You can lose to top 10 teams. You can lose to top 25 teams. You can lose as a 7-point favorite every now and then. That's fine. Every team goes through that, right? Unless you're, you know, one of the absolute powerhouses, you're going to lose games that, you know, fans are going to be ticked off about. But when you lose five games like this as a double-digit favorite, many of which coming off, not this time, but many of which coming off of huge wins, they've done that in the past. They'll have a big win 1 week and then fall flat on their face the next week. That's a pattern now. That's a trend. And it's hard to back a guy after that. It's hard to support a guy after that. I'll say this. Financially, they're not in a position to fire him. It's going to be really, really hard to do it. Fans are already figuring it out. I've seen it. They're figuring out when does the buyout clause kick in for the following year where they can spread out some of the payment. And how they don't have the kind of money to just empty the tank and fire a guy. A program like Tennessee or even Michigan that's getting, you know, $45, $50 million from a television network every year, they can do it. Even in a pandemic, they could probably pull it off. Virginia Tech doesn't have the money. What they need to do is two things that I think are important today. I think Justin Hamilton should be a one-and-done as the DC. And I'm not saying it just because of what happened at the end of the game, but they dealt with a lot of COVID-related roster issues at the beginning of the year. That's over now. And they've had basically their full defense for more or less a month. And you just can't look that unprepared, tackle that poorly against Liberty. Malik Willis was great. He's a Power 5 talent at quarterback. But the rest of that team does not match up to the athletes Virginia Tech has. And yet on Saturday, they made it look like they could. And that's a problem. I think Hamilton's defense has really, really struggled. So I think this guy was literally serving like the pregame meal to the guys 2 years ago and has ascended so quickly that he's replaced Bud. Justin Fuente is going to have to clear, I think, some staff. I don't know who it's all going to be, but some of that staff needs to get replaced. And I think that's always the first step before a coach gets let go. That last ditch effort, right? The entire staff gets overhauled. But I think there's going to be a lot of changes. There need to be a lot of changes, and it's cheaper than buying out a head coach. I will say this. I was talking to just a lady who goes to, or went to Tech years and years ago. She went to Tech in the late 80s. And she is a huge fan. Like, it's not like she just barely follows the program. She watches every week. She went to games growing up. And she told me, you know, this morning she was mentioning, you know, I was there at the end of, or rather when the bowl streak began back in the early 90s. And, you know, Frank Beamer was, I think it was like 24-40 and 2 maybe. There were some ties in there, you know, through his first 6 years. He wouldn't get that kind of leash now. Everybody knows that. It's been said a million times. But I'm not saying this in defense of Fuente, but in the world we live in now, it might be worth giving him, because I do think Fuente can coach, but I do I think recruiting is a huge problem. He needs, he's hired some guys on the staff that can recruit better. That was an issue they've addressed. Maybe it's okay to be a little bit more patient. Maybe I'm overreacting just a little bit, because Saturday night I was done. I was like, this is it. Let's start thinking about who's the next guy. But Frank Beamer did get off to a really, really rough start. And you have to wonder how many other Frank Beamers are out there that don't get the chance to turn programs back around because of one or two, you know, bad years, horrific losses, say whatever you want. Sometimes fans overreact.
That's the thing, though. You said he got off to a really rough start, Beamer, and that's correct. Mac Brown had a similar start at UNC in the first go-round. Dabo did not start off well at Clemson.
Right.
But all those people were inheriting total rebuilds. Fuente did get off to a good start. I think that's the concerning part. And then it has been, aside from, you know, ending the season well last year, it just hasn't gone anywhere except potentially down. I think, and I've made this comparison to you before, maybe even on here, it reminds me of the Larry Fedora era at North Carolina, where Larry Fedora came in, inherited Butch Davis's players after that whole situation went down. Won the Coastal Division with them in 2012, though that was, they didn't play in a championship because of that era. And then he had one more really good run in 2015, 2016, but then personality stuff. I think Larry Fedora is a very smart offensive coach, but it was clear he didn't know how to run a program at that scale in the ACC. And recruiting started to suffer. He stopped recruiting kids in North Carolina. What did Fuente do? He stopped recruiting kids in Virginia and tried to focus on taking some of those North Carolina kids. And I think you can trace a lot of the issues and the perception of the program back to those kind of decisions to ignore the talent in your own state and to be bristly with the media. And again, I don't need to go after him again. We know all that whole situation, but
right.
The parallels are pretty similar to me. So it's not an indictment on him as a football mind. I think he's really smart, but this day and age, it just takes a different kind of leader of a program. And I just don't think he is that guy.
It doesn't feel like it now. And they've got to make some changes. They've got to put more money into the program if they want to truly compete. They're lagging so far behind some of the, you know, top teams in the conference. It's just going to be hard for them to climb back up that mountaintop. But
it's sad to see the fall of Virginia Tech right now. And Josh, after losing to Liberty, you might say that Virginia Tech fans are not handling that fall well.
You're waiting on that one?
Yeah, I wrote it down earlier. I felt like we were getting ready to transition to a different game, so I had to get it in there.
You stuck it in there just in time. All right, well, on that note,
buzzer beater.
On that note, let's talk about some other duds. How concerned are you about Georgia now? Stetson Bennett gets benched. Dwan Mathis comes in, isn't really a whole lot better. I guess, you know, sparked the offense a tiny bit in the second half. But Georgia, after that 14-0 start, I mean, this was all Florida for the last 55 minutes of this ball game. Now that Georgia seems like they are out of the race, you know, in the SEC East, how concerned are you about the Dogs?
Yeah, I mean, for this year, obviously they're out of the race. I mean, I think there's still a decent chance that they put it together. They'll have the most disappointing 8-2 season, but they're basically right back to the Mark Richt era, right, where they go like 9-3, 10-2 every year. I'm not concerned about them long term. They got to get the quarterback situation figured out, you know, longer term for sure. And it looked like they had a couple options going into this season, neither of which are going to play a snap for them. So I'm not as concerned, though. The level of talent that they've accumulated and are continuing to accumulate, like, they're going to be in the discussion every year. They just got to get the quarterback that's going to put him over the top. So not concerned. I mean, one loss. They were beat up. Florida has a fantastic offense. We talked some already about how good offenses are beating good defenses now more than ever. So not super worried, but I think we kind of, they are what they are this year. A very talented defensive team, great lines, but they just don't have all of the pieces together to compete this year.
Yeah. The concern that I would have is in college football, you are always battling your own expectation and dealing with your own perception. And you're right. A lot of talent. Recruiting is at an all-time high. Kirby's competing with everybody in America. Nobody's going to beat Georgia for recruits consistently. They're getting the guys that they want for the most part. Quarterback is a huge issue. I mean, just ask LSU. I mean, LSU last year, you know, figures out the offense. Quarterback, you know, the perfect marriage between him and the coordinator. And they break all these records. They win a title. Georgia's offense is not only stuck in the Stone Ages, but they haven't had good, great quarterback play. Jake Fromm was steady, but Jake Fromm was not spectacular. I feel for them with the fact that it should have been, it could have been Fromm this year, probably should have been Fromm. It could have been Fields, probably should have been Fields in an alternate reality. It could have been, you know, even Jacob Eason could have been up there. I mean, like, they had these guys, they've recruited a bunch of studs. And then, obviously, the Newman situation, the Daniel situation, leads him to Stetson Bennett. So you give him the benefit of the doubt there. But, you know, forget the circumstances. The kids are losing games. And when the pressure starts coming in from fans, from boosters, even from inside the own, you know, their own building, it's hard to combat that. And this is going to be a big test for Kirby because those Rick comparisons are out there. I don't think Kirby is Ricked, but the resumes are strikingly similar. And if you start to get labeled as that, all of a sudden it's going to be hard to fight that perception when you are recruiting, right? And now, like, Florida, Florida is the cream of the crop in that division now, point blank. They have passed Georgia. They were closing the gap, and they have passed them. Now, they're not a mile ahead. It's not a canyon between the two programs, but Florida's the better program now. And Dan Mullen has proven, more so than Kirby, he can do more with less. I'm not saying he has less at Florida, but Dan Mullen has – that guy wins a lot. He did it at Mississippi State. Yeah. He did it early in his career at Florida. Kirby has tended to underachieve more than Dan Mullen has, and I think that would worry me if I was a Georgia fan.
So that's fair. I would push back on point blank Florida has surpassed Georgia as a program. Yes, they won convincingly this weekend, but again, Georgia super beat up. Florida has a historically talented player at tight end, a fantastic offense, no doubt. This is an exceptionally good year for Florida. Let's give it another year or two before we say definitively Florida has passed them. Now, they're right there. Georgia is no longer clearly the team in that division anymore, like they were for several years there. It's 1A and 1B, but I think let's pump the brakes a little bit on Florida having definitely surpassed them. I'm not there yet.
I would say at least temporarily. And, you know, the Mullen,
they're better this year. They proved that. They're better
right,
this year.
Obviously. You know, I think my concern is with the coaching staff is I think Kirby is fine, but Kirby is dealing with the same thing Saban dealt with, but he doesn't have the rings to back it up. If they had beaten Alabama 2 years ago, we're not having this conversation. Or I guess it was 3 years ago now. If they beat Alabama in the national title game, Kirby has got a lot of room for error. Where if there's a down year like this, and I think fans would be like, man, you know, we would have had a great year, but gosh, you know, it's just unfortunate what's happened at quarterback. I don't know that they're really thinking that way right now. A lot of fans, at least, maybe the rational ones, but a lot of people down there are just going to be ticked off that they've lost to Florida now. And it feels like the Gators are ascending. And they figured out offense. They've got a coach who knows how to develop quarterbacks, recruit quarterbacks, and score points. Georgia has not figured that out. And that is priority number one for them figuring out. I don't even know if I could blame Monken that much. I don't know. Maybe Georgia fans will tell me otherwise. But, you know, Monken, the new OC, was supposed to come in and completely turn this thing around. And I mean, he's been dealing with a walk-on at quarterback most of the season, so you feel for him there. How about, you know what, let's Let's move to another dud here. How about BYU Cincinnati, Ross, who are both in the top 10. I think they're 7 and 8 in the AP. Huge win for BYU. Shout out to Zach Wilson, our boy from last week. We were talking him up. He delivered a 3-touchdown performance. He was excellent against Boise State. Cincinnati, yeah, big
win. His parents, Ed and Lisa McCaffrey, were very proud of him.
Yeah. I'm sure brother Christian was looking on admirably on Friday night. But, yeah, so BYU and Cincy, they're kind of screwed now with Florida and Notre Dame winning, it feels like. Especially Notre Dame. But, you know, Alabama is probably going to be undefeated. But if Alabama has one loss, they're going to get in over an unbeaten BYU or Cincinnati team into the playoff. Clemson now with a loss. A one-loss Clemson team is getting in over an undefeated BYU, period. Ohio State, I mean, they're going to run the table. Notre Dame now, again, like, that's the interesting one. Is a one-loss Notre Dame, would they get in over BYU and Cincinnati? I would say yes, depending on how they played the second time around against Clemson. But Florida with the one loss now. If Florida beats Alabama, I would imagine both of those teams are getting into the playoff. And then Texas A&M is lurking out there. And imagine this scenario. Imagine if Florida beats Alabama, which I certainly think is possible. I absolutely think Florida can beat them, especially as banged up as Alabama's getting. They've lost some key guys on offense. No more Waddle. I think Florida could beat them. I don't think Florida's better, but you give me one game, neutral field, I think Florida could win. So if Florida wins, you could have 10-1 Florida with a win over 10-1 Alabama, and then you could have 9-1 Texas A&M who beat Florida. A&M's going to have a hell of a case, and they were dominant on Saturday in their win over South Carolina. I don't see a world in which one of those group of five schools gets in, and that's a shame because both of those teams are really good. At worst case, we just need to get them in a bowl game together. Like, let them play one another.
Yeah, that'd be fun. So if you are a BYU fan or a Cincinnati fan, you are suddenly a big fan of North Carolina, who has a chance to beat Notre Dame in a couple weeks. You were a big fan of Auburn, who could give Texas A&M a loss the end of the regular season. And you're certainly a big fan of Alabama against Florida.
Yes.
If those kind of things start happening, then that fourth spot opens up quite a bit, because then you're potentially looking at an undefeated BYU team with a Heisman contender at quarterback against 6-0 Oregon, or another one loss or two loss SEC team. So that's, I think, where it gets interesting. They are rooting hard for North Carolina against Notre Dame in a couple weeks. That's probably first and foremost.
Yeah, that's going to be it. And it's a shame because, I mean, Wilson is the real deal. Cincinnati, Desmond Ritter is awesome too for Cincinnati. They got a great defense. I mean, they're fun to watch. They dominated Houston on Saturday. When Houston's a pretty talented club. I don't think they're really well coached, but I mean, I love Cincinnati and BYU being in the mix. And that's why I said before about, like, Notre Dame beating Clemson, why that's good. This is great that BYU and Cincinnati are in the mix. I want more teams feeling like they have a chance, which is another reason why we need that 18 playoff. I don't care if it would feel less dramatic in the regular season in the final 2 or 3 weeks. I don't think that's true. But even if that's the argument against it, you know, if BYU and Cincinnati are in, that is a great thing for college football. You need as many programs as you can to feel like they have a chance to play a meaningful ball game in January. That's going to be, I think what makes college football not relevant again, but more relevant, right? Other than just feeling like it's inevitable to go, Clemson, Ohio State, Alabama, and then whoever gets in is the fourth spot. So, man, I hope that happens. I hope we get some chaos, and I hope that they get into the mix, because I'd love to see it, and I'd love to see Zach Wilson play in a game that matters.
We're on to the next one. And, Josh, we got some good lines this week, and so new segment for the people here. We're going to try this out and see how it goes. Would love the feedback on it. So, Josh, we're going to call this spread option. I'm going to give you two games and a line, and you tell me which game this weekend is currently at that line. So, for instance, if I said Team A and Team B versus, and then Team C and Team D, one of these games is -7. You tell me which game it is. Do you understand the rule?
Yes, I came up with the game, so I think I get it.
No, that's unclear. No one else was in the room when it happened.
All right, yeah, let's do it. I like this.
All right, first one. This is what I'm calling the title favorites region. Which of these games has a current spread of 24 points? Ohio State at Maryland, or Alabama and LSU?
Uh, Oh man, so they're both on the road. I'm gonna lean Alabama LSU. Maryland's playing well.
That's correct. Alabama LSU is minus 24 in favor of the Crimson Tide. So Maryland is playing well, but actually Ohio State is favored by 26.5.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yep. So the bigger line there. Yeah. So Alabama though, minus 24, they have only won this game by more than 21 points once since 2002. And that was in 2018. LSU also has only won this game by 21 plus once in that stretch. That was back in 2003. In that same stretch since 2002, this game has gone to overtime 4 times. So historically it's twice as likely to go to overtime than it is to be a blowout. But I don't know, man. It sure feels like Alabama is going to win this game by every bit as of 24. We'll talk about the game itself more on Thursday, but last note on it. If they do win, this would be the first time since 2001 to 2003 that the road team has won 3 straight in this series. So a few different interesting angles to keep in mind there. But yeah, the Tide are favored by 24 at the defending champs.
I'm going
to
tell you right now, Alabama will beat LSU by more than Ohio State beats Maryland. I feel pretty good about that.
I like it.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about that. Now, important note here, as we're recording, LSU is apparently down a lot of guys because of a Halloween party. So they may or may not have a team on Saturday, but which would, honestly, if they do play, they'll be so depleted, it probably makes this line even bigger. But I do think, you know, even if LSU was at relatively full strength, I think Alabama wins more comfortably. And that's a testament. Taulia Tagovailoa, or Tagovailoa, is kind of legit. He's fun to watch.
He's frisky.
I mean, they put up a ton of points, a big comeback against Minnesota. I guess that would have been 2 weeks ago. And then he lit it up again this week. The Tagovailoa is having themselves a couple weeks here.
They really are. Well, we'll see if that continues this weekend. But I was interested to see that those lines were so close for a couple of games. So, all right, number two, Josh, I'm calling this the Pacific Northwest Border Wars. So which of these games has a line of -7.5 or 7.5? Oregon, Washington State, or Washington, Oregon State?
Oh, God. That's a brain teaser.
It is, I know.
Oregon, give me the home and road thing here. I need that.
Oh, geezery, Josh.
Oh, you don't have it. All right. Actually, I think I might have it here. So Oregon's on the road against Washington State. All right, so the Washington teams are at home. A lot of games going up there in the Husky
State.
Correct.
All right. That's what I thought, yes.
7.5-point spread. I feel like it's probably Oregon a 1.5 on the road.
So, yes, Oregon is favored by 7.5. Washington is favored by 12.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Oregon, and I think, you know, obviously that's Washington State's just, you know, much better team than Oregon State. Be very interested to see how good Oregon is. They beat Stanford 35-14. We talk about them, like, keep saying, well, what about a 6-0 Oregon? If they're going to really get into that mix, they got to be winning these games by more than 7 or 8 points. So I'm going to be super interested to see if Oregon is legit. If they cover this spread convincingly against Washington State, then I think we can at least start talking about them. If they don't, if it's a close game, I think their odds of really being in the mix dwindle by the day.
I think that's a great point. I mean, they're fighting, you know, a 6-game schedule, playing these later. I mean, this one's on national TV. They're playing on Fox, but I don't know how many eyeballs are going to be glued to Oregon Wazoo. They're going to need style points big time. And, you know, beating Stanford was nice and all, but Stanford was down a couple key players. They were playing their backup quarterback. There's not a lot about that game that tells you Oregon we need to pay attention to them. But, you know, quite frankly, neither is Washington State. So if we're going to pay attention, go in by 45, go in by 50. I mean, that's what it's probably going to take for Oregon to get, you know, I think the attention that they deserve.
Yep. All right. Number three, Josh, the Go ACC special.
Yes.
Which of these games is at 12.5 right now? Pitt at Georgia Tech or Wake Forest at North Carolina?
There's no way Pitt's favored by 12.5. I got to think it's North Carolina, right?
You are correct. I was surprised by this. This line feels too big for UNC. Wake is like, I think, 13th in Sagarin right now. The computers really love the Demon Deacons. So UNC by 12.5 feels like a lot of points. Pitt, I think, is only favored by like 6.5 right now, Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
So here's the stats for you, Josh, that I think was people were kind of joking about a couple weeks ago, but might actually be legit now. UNC in their 4 noon kicks this year, 4-0, plus 95 point scoring differential. So average margin of victory, just under 24 points. At 4 p.m. or later, they're 1-2 with a minus 2 point scoring margin. Obviously, they lost those two close games and barely beat Boston College. So the reason that is significant, Mac pointed it out, I guess, after the Florida State game, which I had laughed it off as kind of an excuse. They practice at like 6 a.m. every day. The team captains voted on that. So their bodies are very conditioned to these super early schedules. You like a lot of teams in tended to, at least when we were in school, practice in the afternoons. Like they'd get their morning classes out of the way, they'd practice in the afternoons. UNC went the other route, practice first thing in the morning. So their bodies are very conditioned to that by now. So there's this angle out there that maybe is a real thing where they just don't have the same energy or mental focus really for these later kicks. So I'm going to ride UNC in the Mike Hogwood 12 p.m. ACC Network game of the week. That 12.5 feels like a lot, but there's enough betting angles there to where you can kind of understand where the line comes from.
Yeah, and I guess in those night games they lost, kind of slow starts, right? I mean, they were down to UVA at half. They were getting blown out by Florida State, but they were down by a touchdown at halftime to UVA. So, yeah, kind of it takes them a little bit to get going later in the games. That's interesting. Who the heck votes for a 6 a.m. practice?
I don't know. I think they like that they could then have their evenings to like actually do homework and see friends. And of course this year it doesn't really matter, but that was, I think, the logic behind it was like, let's get this out of the way early and then have the rest of the day. But it seems like it might be costing them some games.
Yeah. God, that's backfired, man. Both of those losses, just inexplicable. And you think about how differently this season would look for them. You don't completely fall apart for two quarters against FSU. Your defense gets literally a stop against Virginia. The fake punt obviously was the big one there too. But man, Carolina is this close to 6-0, and it's a very different season for them. Very different season for them. But Wake is sneaky. Wake runs the ball well. We know Carolina struggles to stop the run. I might be leaning Wake on this one. This will be an interesting one, too. I would be tempted to take Wake.
We'll dive more into it on Thursday. All right, last one, Josh, quickly. I'm calling it the Group of Thrive. We're upgrading them from the Group of Five.
Okay.
All right, which of these games has a line of minus 27? Temple at UCF or ECU at Cincinnati?
Probably ECU Cincinnati. Well, man, that might be bigger. I'll go ECU Cincinnati. I'm nervous. I might be wrong.
No, you're right. I was hoping to get it in your head and get you thinking it was a trick question.
Ah.
So it is ECU Cincinnati. UCF, though, they're only minus 18.5 against Temple. The good people at Sagarin would have this as about a 25-point game right now on a neutral field, and it's at UCF. So it feels like close to 10 points too low. Temple got blown out. I don't remember if it was Houston or Tulane.
Tulane
or Tulsa. Tulane, yep. Who UCF beat pretty convincingly. So again, we got one level of transitive property. Not enough of a data point for me right now. That's the point of this early in the week, Josh, the spread option, just to put that one out there. If you're listening, go dive into that. Do a little research and see what might be up here. Because to me, at first glance, that line of UCF by 18.5 seems really tempting.
Yeah, and UCF, low-key, one of the bigger disappointments in college football right now.
Yeah.
I mean, they blow a huge lead to Memphis a few weeks ago, which should never have happened. The Tulsa game the week before, I mean, Tulsa's having themselves a year, but still a game UCF should have won. And quite frankly, like that hurt Cincinnati. You know, I mean, Cincinnati now undefeated. They need, I mean, I guess Tulsa, you know, kind of, Tulsa beating UCF, now Tulsa's all of a sudden looks like one of the upper echelon teams, but they needed UCF to be a top 15 team when they play each other in a couple of weeks. And now that they're not, that could hurt Cincinnati's case too. But it's an interesting look there. Yeah.
Yeah. So last year, a better Temple team lost to UCF 63-21 at home. Mm. I'm just saying, I think people have overreacted a little bit to UCF losing that game to Memphis, losing everything you just said. They have not had the results that people expected, but I think they're still a very good team that has a very good chance of winning this game by 3 or 4 touchdowns.
Yeah, I would like that too. All right. Well, that was Spread Option, and that's it for us today. We'll be back later in the week. We'll have another edition of DraftKings and CraftKings. We'll buy the boat again. We'll dive into – we're going to have to get creative this weekend, Ross. It's not the sexiest slate of games.
Mm-hmm. You say what you want about sexy games, Josh. I've got Maction this week to get me by.
Tuesday
Central
and
Michigan,
Wednesday.
Northern Illinois. What's that?
Tuesday and Wednesday.
That's huge. What a week. So I don't even really care if this weekend is not sexy. I'm going to need to relax after the Maction that gets me through the week.
Oh, baby. I can't wait. All right. That's going to do it for us. We'll talk to y'all later in the week. Don't forget to download, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your enemies, whoever. And we'll see you guys next week. For us, we're out.
See ya.